Man, one week off and I forget how to do everything.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
And by the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex. Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is true.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen. And not a one of you is prepared for it.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road and, you know, anyway. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
This is Drew.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 2007 Oscar award-winning movie, No Country for Old Men.
Yeah, we are.
Produced, directed, edited, and screenplay written by the Coen brothers, Joel and Ethan. Based on a novel by Cormac McCarthy. Costume design by Mary Zofries, who's the wife of comedian and Road Stories podcast host, Marie Valeriano.
Wow, you went deep into the credits.
Well, I just, now that I know that his wife has been the costume designer for the Coen brothers for the last, 10 years, it's interesting to see those connections.
I was actually looking at Coen Brothers movies last night because after watching this, I had to see what other Coen movie brothers I liked and didn't like in comparison.
Miller's Crossing was one of them.
Yeah, because I loved that.
Yeah, well, anyway, Mary Zofri's story is she worked for a designer, a fashion designer, whose name I can't remember. I think it's like Richard Huang or something, who was ill during Fargo and she had to take over. And she had such a bond with the Coen brothers that she's done every movie since Fargo with them as the costume designer.
Wow.
And I believe she's been up for an Academy Award at least once for True Grit, but I don't think she won.
True Grit was a Coen brothers movie?
I believe so, yes.
Interesting. Yeah, I think I like kind of serious Coen brothers. I don't like goofy Coen brothers.
And which one was this?
Yeah, I was going to say, where do you classify this then?
This is more on the serious side.
Yeah.
Really? Okay.
Have either of you read the novel?
No.
No.
Okay, well, I read the novel because, you know, Cormac McCarthy has a pretty prestigious name. So
The Road.
And I guess Blood Meridian is one of the best novels ever written. But I also think it's kind of like a Western novel, so I'm not really interested in that kind of that genre. But I read No Country for Old Men thinking that it was going to be a book of great ideas. And maybe because of the time of my life when I read it the first time many years ago, and when I watched the movie as recently as 2 days ago, maybe I'm still not in that period of life. Maybe this is a movie for a much older man.
So, I love Cormac McCarthy. In fact, I thought The Road was a great book. And the movie, I thought, was a great movie. Notwithstanding my problem with the whole lack of explanation. But I had problems with this. Not the least of which, it actually spawned a dream of which... You and I and Drew were having a group text message, which actually I did check when I woke up this morning that this didn't actually happen, but that you were concerned that I hated the movie and you thought it wouldn't be a good idea that I came on and we podcasted about it if I hated it so much that I should just kind of stay home and you and Drew would discuss it.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, fear not.
I was worried that your dream was going to involve either me or Eric walking ahead of you with a horn with light in it.
Exactly. Fire in the horn. Drew, I believe this is on your list, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, so introduce this movie to us, Drew.
I threw this movie on the calendar because There Will Be Blood was on the calendar. And these two movies have always been linked to me, which is why I was amused with your bit of trivia last time I was on. We talked about There Will Be Blood, that they were actually filmed right next to each other. But I just remember around the time of the Oscars for this year, There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men were both like the front runners. And I watched them both, I think, pretty much back to back, you know, if not over the same weekend, consecutive weekends without another movie in between. And both movies really were thinkers for me. So I pondered them both a lot. And I think I was surprised that No Country for Old Men won the Best Picture that year, because I thought There Will Be Blood was, on the surface, the better crafted movie. But I enjoyed No Country for Old Men the first time I watched it. It was just such a different experience than There Will Be Blood. But just because of the timing of the two, they are always linked in my mind. So I thought it would be an interesting experiment for us to watch them in close proximity as a group and chat about them.
So what did you think? Do you think having watched There Will Be Blood and now No Country for Old Men again, has your opinion changed at all?
Yes, I think my opinion has gotten more extreme. I think There Will Be Blood is in a whole different league than No Country for Old Men. It's just a much richer movie. And I'm saying that even though I really liked No Country for Old Men, I think I liked it more this time around than the first time. Because the first time I watched it, it was, especially the way it ends, it's just like a what-the-fuck movie. So I was able to enjoy it more this time around, but it's just such a different type of movie than There Will Be Blood. It's much lighter, even though there's so much blood and violence in this movie. It really has a much lighter tone. And I think it's not the first time this happened, but I think the Oscars might be on the wrong side of history on this one.
You think this movie had a lighter tone?
Then There Will Be Blood?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
This movie is hilarious.
Well, okay. I'll have to agree with you that it definitely had a lighter tone. But overall, the movies are quite similar. But before I get way in myself, Brother Jay, I sense you have a differing view.
Oh, yeah. I hated this movie. I think it was beautiful. I think it was well acted. I think the story was crap. It did nothing but leave threads and weave nothing together. It wasn't even a very good moral tale.
Yeah, it definitely. I think it partly is Cormac McCarthy is not known for tying things up, apparently. And, you know, he doesn't even use a lot of punctuation, and he is not a fond of things like, I don't know, quotation marks around when people are talking.
Or names.
Or names, yes. So, I don't know. I guess I didn't realize, I couldn't really put a genre on this movie. It's not really a Western, although it could be, because it's set in Texas.
It's a crime thriller.
Kinda. But it's not. It doesn't give you the normal beats of your typical crime thriller, because there's no satisfying ending to it, and there's good guys sort of, and there's bad guys definitely. But one thing I liked about this movie, and I can see where, if you're going for Best Picture, you know, obviously Daniel Day-Lewis did a much better job in There Will Be Blood than anyone did in No Country for Old Men. But No Country for Old Men had great acting performances by more people, I think.
There were way more characters.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. But that makes it for me, like, a more enjoyable experience in that, except, you know, you were following three different roads, let's say.
And this movie was shorter.
Yeah, a little bit. Not a lot shorter, right?
A half an hour.
Maybe if they had a Radiohead soundtrack. I think the score of this movie was 16 minutes total.
There was almost no score.
Yeah, exactly.
I think you put it in a good way, Erica. I enjoyed watching this movie more. It was a more pleasant experience for me, but There Will Be Blood is the better movie. It's just, it's really heavy and exhausting, and this was much easier to get through.
Although I was kind of left in the same place when it was over. Because of Not a Satisfying Ending, it was, you know, it's just a lot. It's, again, everybody is a tragic figure. Maybe I'm not fond of tragedies. I don't know.
I see, it wasn't the tragic that I had the problem with. It was the violence, and that's what I couldn't, like, kept watching the violence again and again. It was just very difficult to watch because it wasn't necessarily integral to the story.
Well, there's also some
sleight of hand with, you know, what the movie makes you think it's about. It makes you think it's about the story of what was his name, Llewellyn Moss, right? The Josh Brolin character.
Yes.
But it's not. As it turns out, it's not about him. He is just part of the narrative that serves the overall story. That is sort of the death of sort of a more black and white generation and the birth of this sort of morally gray generation where ostensibly everything's going to shit.
That was a very generous way of putting it. I think it was more like the death of things that were simple and good and black and white. But not replaced by grayness and ambiguity, but more like replaced by evil.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I got from it. And that's why, you know, the whole idea, No Country for Old Men. I guess I was just expecting more. And in the book, the sheriff, Ed Tom Bell, is the constant narrator. And in the movie, it's pretty well divided into the three stories. Shall we just dive into the plot?
Yeah, one more thing. Jason, tell me you would not watch, like, a weekly sitcom with Detective Bell and John Henry. Because they were awesome.
Oh. They were. And like I said, I think this is well acted. I just think the story was lacking. I didn't like the story. And the story didn't bring me... I had to force myself to finish watching this movie. I had no desire to see how the movie ended.
When I started watching it again, I had forgotten a particular aspect of it, which I don't know if it hit you as hard as I thought it might hit you, but there's some people on dog violence in this movie.
Well, and so I do have a problem with that, and but the dog violence wasn't as bad for me because, you know, when we get to the point, it was very clearly a very bad facsimile. Stunt dead dog. But, and you know, it always bothers me when it's dogs, especially because they were pit bulls. But, so that didn't bother me as much as just, kind of the over the top, bloody, gory violence, which didn't seem to, was never explained. It's little things like that that take me out of a movie. And because it was such a gimmicky thing, the fact that it was never explained, it just is even more, and maybe that's a Cormac McCarthy thing, because that was, again, my same compulsion against The Road, so.
Okay, well, I guess, shall we just dive in then?
Yeah.
Okay, what I put in my note, the tagline to this movie, the line on the poster says, "There are no clean getaways," which could be said about a lot of Coen Brother movies. And actually just a lot of good stories, like noir fiction has a lot of that, where, you know, you have somebody trying to get away. Like this, A Simple Plan is a tale of that. Mm-hmm. And most heist movies, I think, too. Yeah, so I also wrote down that the story is a tale as old as time, a song as old as rhyme. Because it's pretty basic.
Yeah, but this ain't no Disney film.
Well, I think you're right, Jeroen. The fact that it's telling a relatively simple story, but it's conveying a bigger message.
Right.
Yep.
It starts out, but this is actually, apparently a lot of the dialogue is lifted pretty much directly from the novel. What's not lifted directly from the novel is the opening. Like, all the words and sentiments are in it. In the book someplace, but the opening narration of this movie where we meet the Ed Tom Bell character, the old sheriff, doing his monologue. And I'll put it in here because it's amazing. And Tommy Lee Jones, I can't think of anybody better to deliver that speech.
I was sheriff of this county when I was 25 years old. Hard to believe. My grandfather was a lawman. Father, too. Me and him were sheriffs at the same time, him up in Plano and me out here. I think he's pretty proud of that. I know I was. Some of the old-time sheriffs never even wore a gun. A lot of folks find that hard to believe. Jim Scarborough never carried one. That's the younger Jim. Gaston Borkins wouldn't wear one up in Comanche County. I always like to hear about the old-timers. Never missed a chance to do so. You can't help but compare yourself against the old-timers. Can't help but wonder how they'd operated these times. There's this boy I sent to the electric chair at Huntsville here a while back. My arrest and my testimony. He killed a 14-year-old girl. Papers said it was a crime of passion, but he told me there wasn't any passion to it. Told me that he'd been planning to kill somebody for about as long as he could remember. Said if they turned him out, he'd do it again. Said he knew he was going to hell. Be there in about 15 minutes. I don't know what to make of that. I surely don't. The crime you see now, it's hard to even take its measure. It's not that I'm afraid of it. I always knew you had to be willing to die to even do this job. But I don't want to push my chips forward and go out and meet something I don't understand. A man would have to put his soul at hazard. He'd have to say, okay. I'll be part of this world.
I think the actors here were really well cast, except maybe for Javier Bardem. But we'll get there.
No, he was great.
I think just having rewatched Skyfall, I had a hard time separating.
Yeah, well, when they asked him about playing, they went after him, and he said. He was like, well, I don't like violence, and I don't speak English well. Why do you want me for this? They're like, oh, no, that's why we want you for this. And then they gave him that haircut. Were you as offended by that haircut as I was?
Of course. I think it's the point.
Yeah, well, it is the point. I guess the Coens used a photo of a brothel patron taken in 1979, and when he first saw the haircut, Javier Bardem said... the quote is, oh no, now I won't get laid for the next 2 months. And in response, the Coen brothers started a series of high fives. And they were saying, okay, the haircut makes him as creepy as possible.
By the way, my notes.
Very short. Yes, there's two lines of notes. One short line.
No, actually, there's one line of notes because the first line is the title.
You want to just hit us with all your notes all at once? Give me a note talk with Brother Jay.
It's from the opening. It's from the opening desert scene where I said, "quote He really goes opening car doors he can't see through at a massacre site."
Well, okay.
And then I gave up. Then I was just like, "I'm done."
Oh, jeez. Yeah. So we have this great opening by Sheriff Ed Tom Bell. Out in West Texas in 1980. And then we meet Anton Chigurh, although we don't know until later what his name is. This is another movie I was afraid that, except for the narration, this is going to be another There Will Be Blood, because the first part of this movie doesn't have a whole lot of dialogue. Like, the main characters
there's
don't
not,
talk at all.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of dialogue throughout the whole movie. Like, nobody is really too verbose, except for the opening and closing, you know, the bookends by Tommy Lee Jones. Everything else is really... they use words sparingly in this movie.
But effectively, everybody gets some monologues that are great.
Except when Tommy Lee Jones goes to talk to his uncle or cousin or brother, whoever he is. They have a big, long conversation.
A little bit. I mean, there are some long conversations, but yeah, it's very interesting. I really like the dialogue in this movie.
Yeah, but even that conversation with his brother, you know, I think the important part about that is what's not said. You know, they're kind of talking around, you know, what they're both thinking about is their own mortality. And they're talking about it in terms of God and the violence that was perpetrated on his brother, but not really addressing it directly.
Well, and this is a movie about violence, but it's also a movie about inevitability and maybe like determinism. Like, are these, you know, there's the whole question throughout this movie is, are these characters like destined to continue, you know, are they going on a path that they can't get out of? So, and they play with that a little bit. But yeah, so we meet Anton Chigurh, who's Javier Bardem, who is arrested by a sheriff's deputy. And they return to the police station, and the deputy is actually talking on the radio about how his prisoner has this weird, like, oxygen tank thing. It's like a cylinder of some sort of compressed gas and like a little button-looking thing, handle-looking thing. And he's not sure what it is, the deputy isn't. And Chigurh isn't talking at all. But we have this great scene of the deputy on the phone with the sheriff. Is he on the phone with Sheriff Bell, or is this a different county?
I thought it was a different county.
Yeah, I thought so too. The IMDb synopsis says he's talking to Bell, but I don't think so. He's talking to his own sheriff, though, about this guy who's arrested. And in the background, you see Javier Bardem slip his cuffs to the front and then go up behind the deputy. And without speaking, and in a really long kind of scene, he chokes him out and kills him. In a very, like, bloody and probably somewhat realistic fashion.
Oh, it was beautiful too. It was such a great visual. So there was so much rich detail in the scene visually, because, you know, after he's choking him for a while and the deputy's kicking around, blood starts to spurt out, and you can't tell if he's actually cutting into the deputy's throat, but you don't find out until afterwards that it's because he's pulling on the cuffs and the cuffs are actually cutting into his wrists. So that's his blood spurting out. But also, the floor is completely scuffed around the boots of the deputy when they're done.
Well, both of them, actually.
Which is a great little detail.
Oh, yeah. And it actually reminded me that the scene of the actual strangulation reminded me of a little bit of, like, the Hannibal TV show. Or even the best of the Hannibal movies, where it's kind of an dramatic, like, operatic violence.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't think he was talking to Bell on the phone?
Well, I got the impression he was not.
I kind of thought that he was, considering it kind of foreshadows the kind of inept and incompetency that he displays in his pursuit as a lawman.
You mean Bell's pursuit?
Yeah.
Oh, I think Bell was fucking straight up, like, badass cop.
I don't think so.
John Henry wasn't so experienced, but Bell seemed to be, you know, just behind Chigurh, but he had the senses right. He had the instinct right. He just couldn't leap ahead as fast.
He didn't seem interested. He didn't want to have anything to do with the other investigation later on in the movie, and he pretty much intimated as to the weapon, but then didn't connect the dots.
I don't know. I guess I didn't really get that. Because he followed the investigation all the way to the end.
Yeah, I thought he was super competent. He was competent and confident and wanted nothing to do with the feds because, in his opinion, they would have provided no value to what he was going after.
Yeah, and he definitely had a certain way of doing things. that had worked for him over a very long period of time. You know, in the opening, they talked about how he had been a sheriff since he was 25, and he's got to be more than double that now, because he's retirement is looming for Sheriff Bell.
Mm-hmm.
But, so Chigurh takes the deputy's squad car, and he does a traffic stop to stop a motorist driving a Ford sedan. And that's when we learn what this little gizmo he's got is. It's a captive bolt pistol. It's like a pneumatic powered bolt gun that they use to kill cattle, I guess, or wildlife.
Yeah, I've never seen one before, but it looks super creepy in this movie.
Yeah. Well, if you remember, certainly Brother Jay, if you remember the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the hitchhiker that they picked up talked about how he was going to lose his job because he was really good at hitting the hogs or the cows with like a sledgehammer, but since they instituted this bolt gun thing, he was going to be put out of a job.
I've forgotten about that.
Yeah, it turns out you remember some of the other things more vividly. I'm guessing this is sort of a joke. I'm guessing Brother Jay has not seen the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
That would be correct.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it for a couple weeks from now. It's actually kind of a rough movie to watch.
Yeah, just as a tangent, one of the most disturbing things about that movie that stuck with me over the years was... I hope this is the right movie. It's been so long since I watched it. I think there's a scene in the beginning where a dude in a wheelchair is trying to take a piss and ends up falling down a hill and like urinating all over himself.
Maybe. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely an annoying guy in a wheelchair.
Yeah. And yeah. I found that to just be so sad and tragic. That was the most disturbing thing from that movie.
Yeah, no, the guy in the wheelchair is sad and tragic, but also you don't like him for much the same reason that you don't like, I forget his name, Paul Dano's character in There Will Be Blood. Eli, or whatever was it?
Eli, yeah.
But anyway, yeah. So we see Chigurh take out this motorist in a very, you know, very assassin-like way with this captive bolt pistol. Then we go to a scene where we meet Llewellyn Moss, played by Josh Brolin, you know, from Goonies and Milk and W. And he reminded me a little bit of Bob Seger. Maybe it was just the hair pattern.
I didn't get Bob Seger at all.
But, so he's out actually hunting, and he takes a shot at this deer or whatever it is, and goes down to find it. The deer runs off, so he's got to go and track it down, and he sees this trail of blood that's going in the opposite direction that the deer ran off, and he sees that it's the blood of a wounded dog, and he didn't wound the dog, so he traces the dog's trail and ends up finding these several pickups that are parked in kind of circling the wagons kind of pose. And it's like carnage. It's this massive gunfight where everybody is apparently dead and hundreds of rounds have been expelled in this gunfight. And there's all these automatic weapons and shotguns and things laying around from all the dead people. And during this whole thing, he hardly says anything, which is pretty great.
Yeah, he's a cool customer, this Moss guy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they don't really get into his past at all, actually. Which I think was probably good, because, you know, there's limited time that you had with these three main characters. But he ends up, seeing these apparently Mexican criminals, and also at least one dead dog. And then he finds the guy in a vehicle who appears to be mortally wounded and wants water. And he didn't have any water, Which, by the way, you'd think he would have some kind of water, but apparently not.
And a truckload full of drugs is what he found.
Yeah. He found in the bed of the pickup is a serious amount of what apparently is heroin. And he ends up taking like an Uzi and a separate magazine from the guy. And he goes off to find out where the last man standing is, because he figures there's probably money where there's drugs. So he's going to hunt the last man. And he kind of looks around and says, where would I go? And he'd go find shade. And so he went over and finds this guy under a tree, dead. And he finds this big catalog case that's full of... Well, what we find out is about $2 million in cash.
Not too shabby for a day's worth of hunting.
Yeah, no, and this is where all the trouble starts. So, he takes the money and the gun, and he returns home to his mobile home. And he hides the Uzi underneath. He removes, like, the skirting and hides it up underneath, like, in what's the crawl space, but basically. But he goes into the house with a big old case of money and his new shiny gun. And his wife, Carla Jean, played by Kelly MacDonald, from, by the way, Trainspotting, Boardwalk Empire, Brave, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, and Gosford Park. And they have wonderful dialogue. Again, I don't really like Westerns necessarily. I mean, there are plenty of Westerns I like, but I don't like, you know, I don't get... I have no nostalgia or... love of the, you know, Southern or Southwest accent, but I thought all the dialogue was delivered really well in this case, because you got this conversation between Carla Jean and Llewellyn, and she's all like, you know, where'd you get the pistol? He's like, at the getting place. And that's the beginning of the long conversation.
Yes, they're both very folksy with each other.
Yes, they are, and they apparently live a modest lifestyle.
And he gets her to stop talking at one point by threatening to take her in the back and screw her.
Yes.
they both acknowledge that she doesn't want that.
Exactly. But late that night, Moss is apparently either he wakes up or he never got to sleep. And he decides that he's got to go take care of further business down at that site. And he goes and... fills up a big jug of water. He's going to take water down to the guy in the pickup.
Looks like Flint, Michigan water, too.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. And Carly Jean is wondering, what's he doing?
You know, back in 1980, they didn't have well-established secondary treatment standards for drinking water.
Good to know. So she asks him where he's going, and he's like... I'm fixing to do something dumber than hell, but I'm gonna anyways. So, it's nearly dawn, and he drives out there, and he's carrying this gallon of water, and then he discovered that the wounded guy has actually been killed by a shotgun round to his head, and he sees, up by where he's parked his truck, he sees other headlights of another truck. And so the chase is on.
Now, did you think Moss went back to this place just because he felt guilty about not having any water for this guy? Or do you think he had some other ulterior motive? Was he going back for the drugs or for something else?
I thought he was going back for the drugs.
Okay. But why bring the water?
Exactly. That's the thing. The water would indicate that in the synopsis where it says he's going back with the water for the guy. But yeah, you'd think he would have had that much water in the daytime.
Yeah, he didn't really seem to have that much of a conscience. But maybe he did.
I think the water was just a cover story in case something else happened.
So you think he was going back for the drugs also?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in for a penny.
No, I don't know anything about these drugs. I saw this guy look that hairy. He was thirsty. Got him some water.
So, well, when they start firing on him, with automatic weapons, he takes off running. And this is the part where I'm like, oh, Brother Jay's going to have a hard time with this one. Because Llewellyn jumps down an embankment and takes off his shoes and dives into the river. And they send a pit bull after him to chase him down. And it's actually a...
It turns miraculously daytime very quickly.
Well, it's dawn.
Within minutes. Mere minutes.
Oh, it goes really fast when you don't live in Alaska. It's freaky.
Yeah, so he's swimming downstream, and he's wounded. And the dog is chasing him, and I thought that was actually a brilliant scene. Except for the end of the scene...
I thought the whole thing was brilliant with him, you know, just drifting downstream with the dog paddling after him. It was so slow, but it's so tense. It was great.
Oh yeah, and the fact that he takes the gun out and has to clear the chamber and chamber a fresh, hopefully dry round after he blows out the barrel, and he's just, you know. He's just hoping this is going to work because he only has one shot at this thing. Literally. Right. But the dog leaps at him and he kills it. And yeah, much like A Fish Called Wanda, they substituted a dog that didn't look too realistic. So he returns home, like barefoot, and he basically sends Carla Jean to go to Odessa to stay with her mom while he's going to travel elsewhere with the money. And then we have a scene where Shiger shows up at a filling station and goes to pay for some like cashews from the owner of the filling station, the convenience store kind of guy, played by Gene Jones. And a really great scene, except that, I don't know, there was something slightly off about it. I mean, everything, like I thought that the gas proprietor guy, his dialogue was great, but I think Javier Bardem just doesn't quite do it, although he won an Academy Award for this role.
I thought this is great. This is sort of the epitome of Shiger, because he's so good at what he does, you know, as far as being like a hunter and a contract killer. And I think Javier Bardem has such a natural charisma that this scene really sucks all of the charisma out of Shiger, because it's so mean-spirited. You know, you could almost see like the Vic Mackey effect for Anton Shiger if Bardem played him with more charisma, where you would still be rooting for him even though he's a monster, just because, you know, he seems like such a badass dude. But this scene establishes that he's not nice. He's in no way charming. He's just a mean, cold-blooded murderer who you have no sympathy for because he picks on an old man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's toying with this guy.
He's not really a good killer either, because he can't just kill. He has to give himself an excuse to kill.
Well, sometimes.
He can't kill the guy outright, even though he has contempt and wants to kill the guy. He has to make it the guy decide that the guy wants to be killed by the coin flip.
Yeah, well, and that's it comes back later. But, yeah, he has his own code, Shiger does, of a sort.
Not really.
But, yeah, he flips a coin. And the guy wins his life.
Yeah, done in a different way. That could be like a very Fight Club moment where, you know, Shiger could have given this guy the gift of really being able to appreciate his life. But no, the way it's portrayed is just
put
tense
that in your pocket
and uncomfortable. Yeah.
Oh yeah, and you're not off the hook. He could come back at any moment and kill you.
Right.
Yeah. So like I said, it's a good scene, but I don't know. Maybe I guess it was all the tension and the bad haircut, because the bad haircut took me a long time. I was really angry at that hair.
Again, I just saw Skyfall.
Well, and you just wonder, like, where the hell does he come from? Because he's got a name that doesn't sound like it comes from... I mean, Anton sounds, you know, kind of European. And Shiger, they hardly, you know, say the name. And when they do, most people just call him, like, Sugar. So you have no idea where he's supposed to come from. And he's got a little bit, because of his accent, to me, he was a little bit of Benicio del Toro in The Usual Suspects.
Oh, that's funny. I watch every movie with subtitles, so it didn't catch me off guard. But I don't think it mattered where he came from. I mean, he's essentially just the devil.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. Yeah.
So this gimmick is pointed out to me by a friend that the gimmick of this is stolen from the comic book world, Two-Face.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, it's the coin flipping thing is definitely a Two-Face trait. But this isn't, I mean, he's not, like, Two-Face is kind of a, I guess a pure character is a little bit overstating it. But my understanding of the Batman universe is that Two-Face really does play by the rule of the coin flip. And you get an idea that maybe Shiger doesn't.
Yeah, Two-Face is also, like, driven by the coin flip constantly. Like, it's a mental problem. It's not just that he does it to make a point, like Shiger. Like, he always has to be flipping the coin for pretty much every decision he makes.
But yeah, no, it's not entirely new. And I think maybe in the book, and I guess in the movie, the whole idea of that cattle gun thing was really novel. And, you know, in the movie, I think it's interesting, but it's never really fully explained. And he doesn't use it continuously through the movie. So, you know, it's almost like a James Bond gadget. And it also seems kind of unwieldy just to carry around.
It's not very... It's very conspicuous.
Yeah, I mean, it's quiet. And it does that thing with door locks, which is handy.
Yeah, and that's why he doesn't use it all the time.
Yeah, well. But yeah, so later that night, Shiger meets up with these two, I guess, they refer to him as like managerial types, who take him out to the scene of the shootout. They ask him if he minds writing bitch, which was funny because the first time I heard that, I'm pretty sure if it wasn't in Mexico, it was by somebody who was born in Mexico. So, they go down and, they find Llewellyn's truck and he takes the VIN tag off of the door. And the well-dressed guys tell him that they have this tracking device in the money, but they haven't been able to find it. And Shiger then looks around and then shoots these guys dead. And the following morning, we have Sheriff Bell, Tommy Lee Jones, of course, and Deputy Wendell, played by Garrett Dillahunt, John Henry. I don't know about you, but I was like grinning from ear to ear when I saw John Henry was in this movie. I had forgotten completely.
And it made me laugh out loud.
Because that dude is rolling 20s.
And he's so great. I love Wendell so much.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Wendell, like, he seems to be like day 4 on the job for Wendell. He's very earnest.
He is. No, I think he's got more experience than that, but yeah. He does have an earnest outlook.
It definitely...
Oh, that's so aggravating. That is just really aggravating.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's... And, yeah, you're right. I would like
he's
to... Kind I would of love the, to see the TV
kind of
show.
The Barney, he's kind of the Barney Fife.
Oh, exactly. And the accents are kind of Andy Taylor accents in some cases. And the fact that he talks, you know, in kind of a wistful tone at the beginning of how some of the old sheriffs he admires never carried a gun. You know, that whole Sheriff Andy Taylor was all based on a sheriff who didn't carry a gun. So, and of course, Barney, he had a gun, but he was only allowed one bullet. And he had to keep it in his pocket. If you don't remember that, it's a...
I never watched that show.
It's actually kind of a fun show. It's not bad. And Don Knotts is great. And actually, Andy Griffith is great, too. And you know what? Little Opie Cunningham is fantastic. And Aunt Bee. Everybody's great. Creepy Floyd the Barber. Ugh. Yeah. Anyway.
Was Gomer Pyle in that show?
Yep. Gomer and Goober. Oh, yeah. No, it's, it's very interesting. Okay, so, we meet Wendell, Deputy Wendell, and, they go to the shoot outside, they find the truck, because the sheriff actually recognizes the truck as belonging to Llewellyn. Yeah, so they call the federal authorities and he wants nothing more to do with it, pretty much. But I love the little, like, I think you're right. I want to see the television series that involves Ed Tombell and Wendell.
Well, it's a mess, ain't it, Sheriff?
If it ain't, it'll do till the mess gets here.
Yeah, Detective Bell is full of little folksy one-liners, which are just awesome. I wish I could remember some, but some of them are almost oxymoronic.
Oh, yeah. No, it's great. Yeah, like little, like, witticisms. Yeah, it's great. So, so Shakur shows up at Moss and Carla Jean's trailer, and he uses his little cow gun to break the lock.
Not break the lock, just blow the bolt out of the lock.
Yeah, all the way into the back wall, which is great. And he finds a phone bill that has... remember phone bills that had phone numbers on it? Maybe they still do, but I can't imagine.
My cell phone bill still does.
Oh, well, maybe mine does too. I just never call anybody.
I don't pay for long distance, so mine doesn't itemize unless you specifically ask for a copy.
Yeah, I think maybe that's the case with us too. Yeah, and then, by the way... I love the fact that, you know, Shagur may be like a single-minded force of a badass assassin, but he's not a superhero. Although he kills most people he talks to in this movie, he doesn't kill everybody, including the trailer park manager, who's played by...
It's not from lack of want, though.
No, it's Kathy Lamkin from Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, by the way. And she is great because he's trying to do his sugar intimidation tricks on her. And she's like, oh no, I don't think you heard me, sir. I'm not going to be helping you today.
This is after he sits down and they have the whole milk thing.
Well, yeah, So Wendell and the Sheriff Bell show up after Sugar gets there and find out that there's Sugar has left this bottle of milk sitting out on the coffee table in the living room, and there's still condensation on it, and that's where Wendell's
that's later, because you skip the part where, you know, Bell makes him go first.
Yeah.
Well, I'm standing behind
you. Oh, yeah, exactly. Well, you...
gun out and up.
What about you? Oh, no, I'll be behind you.
That's just benefits of being the boss.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yes. Delegation is important. And then he drinks the milk, which I don't think is a good idea, personally. Like, granted, this is 1980, but still, seems all sorts of wrong drinking the milk.
Sorry for your lactose intolerance.
Yeah. So anyway, Moss puts his wife on the bus. And he's going to come for her in a couple days. And he goes to a motel where he rents a room and cleverly hides the money in the ventilation ducts.
That I'm sure no one else in the entire place could hear, because none of those ducts are connected or anything.
Yeah, he was banging around quite a bit, but I thought it was clever. It puts you in a certain frame of mind. And it made it more important when he comes back later with his tent poles. Because he's going to go fishing to get that thing out. Very interesting.
He's very industrious. You get the idea that he's done this before.
Yeah, definitely. He's definitely thinking on his feet. So Shagur has this tracking thing, you know, crude 1980, like homing device or whatever, that basically just beeps when it gets close and beeps faster when it gets closer. And he's trying to track down where Moss might go, and ends up finding the motel.
Stumbling across it.
Yeah. In the meantime, Moss has rented the room behind his room. And you know, again, all this interaction with all like the simple folks of the like the motel staffs of the places they go to are like, you know, why are you doing that? It makes no sense. You want another room?
Yeah, he rents another room because when he comes back, he notices that the blinds are they've been moved from where he left them.
Oh yeah, no, he's just gonna use that the stuff he bought to try to fish this his bag of money out the back way. But what he suspects is, you know, well, I guess he doesn't know Sugar is after him, but he suspects somebody's gonna be after him. So what we don't know is that it's not Sugar that's in the hotel room, because Sugar shows up just later and uses his trick on the door and ends up finding a bunch of Mexicans in the hotel room and kills all of them. And Moss escapes out the back.
And that actually leads to maybe one of my favorite Detective Bell or Sheriff Bell quotes. Is when later when Wendell is relaying to him that...
The motel in Del Rio.
Yes, sir. None of the three had ID on them, but they tell me that all three's Mexicans. Was Mexicans.
There's a question. Whether they stopped being. And when.
Yes, sir.
It's like, that doesn't go anywhere, but I just love his little observation of the odd Wendell syntax.
Yes. So, Moss actually escapes by hitchhiking, and the driver, played by Matthew Greer from The Mist, actually tells him that he shouldn't be hitchhiking because this is dangerous out in West Texas. And then the next day, we visit a high-rise office building in Dallas, Texas, where a bounty hunter named Carson Wells, played by Woody Harrelson, arrives in a businessman's office. Businessman is played by Stephen Root from...
True Blood.
News Radio.
Office Space. And Dave. And, you know, Woody Harrelson is doing his Woody Harrelson thing. He's always very charming. Again, I don't imagine I would want to, like, hang out with Woody Harrelson. But he has a very captivating screen presence. In pretty much everything he's ever been in. Well, maybe not the romantic comedies.
He's been in romantic comedies?
I want to say he has. Maybe not. Maybe I'm actually confusing him with McConaughey.
Yeah, I think you may be confusing him.
Well, Woody Allen. Woody Harrelson was on... had like a relatively long run on Will and Grace.
Yes, he did.
In a comedy romance kind of thing. Oh, mostly comedy though.
Oh well, he had a romance on Cheers back in the day.
Kelly, 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 Kelly,
Kelly, Kelly, Kelly, Kelly,
K-E-L-L-Y? Yeah. yeah, and of course, you know, Natural Born Killers is a romance of a kind. The businessman is upset about how many people Sugar keeps killing. He just wants to get the money back. So he hires Woody Harrelson to go and track down Sugar and get the money. And the Carson Wells character, the Woody Harrelson character, he knows of Sugar. He knows him by sight. He knows that he's a dangerous guy. He's a straight-up psychopathic killer. But he also kind of like intimates that he himself is probably a psychopathic killer too. But in the meantime, in a border town, Llewellyn rents a room in this older, rundown, multi-story hotel, where he gives the guy extra money to tell him if anybody at all shows up, any swinging dick.
He never gets that call.
No, he never does. It becomes a problem. Although, again, his insomnia helps him out because he's trying to puzzle out, he can't sleep, but he's trying to puzzle out why the hell the people keep finding him. So he opens up the case, or instead of just dumping the case out on the bed, like he did in when he and Dinty Moore and Robert Redford did that movie. I'm thinking of Woody Harrelson still. Josh Brolin.
Wow.
Indecent Proposal. Anyway, so... getting my movies mixed up. So Josh Brolin finds a transmitter in the bag. At the same time, Sugar finds him. And he calls down, and there's no answer at the front desk, and the old guy working down there said he's going to be on till 10 in the morning, so somebody should answer the phone. And that's where we see what turns out, trivia, the silencer for the shotgun is a made-up thing. There is no such thing. But it looks very cool, doesn't it?
It does.
And you get the tension of hearing the bleeper from the transponder receiver.
Oh, yeah, and you get to see, like, the light from underneath the door frame. It's great. It's like an Alfred Hitchcock moment. Because everybody knows what's coming, but you're still, you know, you're still, like, that creates the tension. And then, of course, the lock hits him, which is hilarious. Because he doesn't know it's coming, but we do. But luckily, that inspires him to shoot and dive sideways. And so now the chase is on.
And it's a fun chase.
It is a fun chase. So eventually there's a little yada yada chase, and Moss stops a pickup truck driver played by Luke Rains from Outlaws and Angels.
Briefly.
Yeah, it tells him to drive. Well, that doesn't go well. But in the ensuing gunfight, he shoots and wounds Chigurh. But he's also wounded. So they end up having to go like separate ways and across the border and tend to their own wounds. Now, in the novel, it's like 5 days that it takes Chigurh to clean up his wounds and get healthy. But they don't really, the time isn't really a big important part of this movie. They don't dwell on it, at least. But he uses some subterfuge involving Moss does, dressing up like a drunk Mexican and shuffling across the border after he dumps the money over a fence.
Yeah, he's so smart. This seemed a little out of character for him. Not didn't seem very well thought out.
No, but then again, he's wounded too, so... yeah, so he ends up being awoken by
a mariachi band.
Yeah, exactly. Meantime, we go back to Sheriff Bell, and I think this is the place, but if it's not, it's a good example anyway of, again, the repartee between Wendell and Sheriff Bell. Wendell says, so you think this boy Moss has any notion of the sorts of sons of bitches that are hunting him? And Bell says, I don't know, he ought to. He's seen the same things I've seen, and it certainly made an impression on me. So Sheriff Bell goes to visit Carla Jean in Odessa. And they have this conversation, this wistful conversation, about how a local farmer was nearly killed by an animal he was trying to slaughter, so now the slaughterhouses use that compressed air guns to kill cattle.
Yeah, which, you know, earlier when they talked about the motorist being killed, they had no idea what might do that.
Yeah, there is no ding, 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 ding moment in this. Like, he's not... Like, Sheriff Bell is, you're right, he's not Sherlock Holmes in this whole thing. He's sort of stumbling across this and...
Describes exactly the wound.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah. But whether he has that figured out doesn't really matter. I mean, that's all kind of academic, right? Not his case. So, Carson tracks down Llewellyn in a Mexican hospital, and they have some witty dialogue about how, you know, Carson just says, well, you know, tell me where the money is. I may even let you keep a little bit of it, but you don't want to mess with Chigurh. And Llewellyn's like, no, I'm good.
He says he spent it all.
Yeah, well, both of them are trying to out-cool each other, which is pretty hilarious, actually. So, you know, Carson keeps saying, no, you don't understand. You can't deal with somebody like Chigurh. You know, he's not like you. He's not even like me. And Moss says, he don't talk as much as you, so I give him points for that. Yeah, so this is like a pissing contest of cool. But on the way back, Carson sees that catalog case over the bridge. And he ends up going to his hotel where he and Chigurh have a confrontation. And Chigurh has the upper hand on Wells. And they have some a brief dialogue between them, and then the phone rings, and Chigurh just dispatches Woody pretty fast.
Yeah, that phone ringing was a nice little jump scare.
Oh, yeah. It's, of course, it is Llewellyn calling for Carson, but since Chigurh answers the phone, Chigurh tells him that he knows exactly where he is, and instead of going to kill him in the hospital, he's just going to go to Carla Jean's mother's house. And then Moss sort of gets to be a badass here. He's like, well, I want to make you a special project. So now, apparently we're setting up like a tale of two badasses.
Except the badass loses his temper.
Well, yeah, it turns out this is not the case.
No, that's just the movie makers fucking with the audience.
Exactly, yeah. So Llewellyn calls up Carla Jean and tells her to fly to El Paso to meet him. And, of course, Carla Jean takes her mom, which, by the way, I thought the mom was fucking fantastic.
She's not used to seeing a Mexican in a suit, that's for sure.
So if you've ever seen the movie Sordid Lives, you would recognize her.
Sordid Lives?
Yeah, Sordid Lives, L-I-V-E-S. Olivia Newton-John.
Oh, no, I have not.
No, it sounds like a winner, though.
It's a great black comedy about the South. Well, about being gay in the South, so it's very hilarious.
Starring Olivia Newton-John?
It has Olivia Newton-John and Delta Burke and Jeff Bridges.
Wow.
Maybe not Jeff Bridges. I'm sorry, maybe it's... No, it's not Jeff
Matthew
Bridges.
McConaughey?
Bo Bridges.
Bo Diddley. Yeah. Nah, can't do anything with Diddley, sorry.
Diddley squat, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Well, Beth Grant is the actress's name, and she was also in Donnie Darko, A Time to Kill, and Speed. And in the meantime, Chigurh has pulled off the side of the road. He wants to take,
Bo Bridges.
Oh, it is Bo Bridges. That's hilarious.
Yes!
good job. So, Chigurh ends up stealing a chicken truck. Yeah, so we end up having this, you know, all...
He murdered every single one of those chickens off screen, right?
Oh, yeah. Individually, with the cattle gun. Yeah. He looked in the eye and said, hold still. Yes.
Flipped a coin every time.
He flipped his chicken.
Yeah, he did flip his chicken. Hats off to Connie. Two words. Apple butter. Yeah. So everybody's converging on El Paso.
Yeah, Carla Jean tells Belle that that's where Llewellyn's going. So Belle heads there.
And then you get this weird scene where Moss is coming back to his hotel and he's being flirted at by this lady at the pool.
I love this scene.
It's a great scene, but again, like a lot of the scenes in this movie, it's kind of there for flavor, but doesn't really go anywhere. I mean, I guess it goes one place.
No, it's supposed to portray him that he's a good guy because he's not going to cheat on his wife.
Yeah, well, yeah.
It also sets up some of the collateral damage.
Exactly, yeah.
But there's no John Henry here to see the massacre of the pool death.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Hey, there you go. Callback. Very nice.
Yeah.
So Sheriff Bell is driving into El Paso and hears a bunch of gunfire and sees a crazy-ass pickup truck leaving, being chased by people trying to catch up to their own getaway driver. And he looks, and he drives into the hotel area and sees the dead lady in the pool and goes back. And I had to rewind it, because at first I wasn't sure that was Llewellyn who was dead in the room.
Yes, it shocked me the first time I saw the movie, and I'd forgotten exactly what happened, and it shocked me the second time I saw the movie.
Really, it didn't surprise me in the least. I had expected it.
I didn't expect it to happen off screen.
Well, exactly. Yeah, it was kind of a not a hero's death in this movie. But Carla Jean shows up, and like all Belle can do is kind of, console her in his wordless Southern way. And he and the local sheriff, played by Roger Boyce, have coffee and talk about the declining morals of American society. And Sheriff Bell returns to the motel and I guess nearly misses being killed by Chigurh, who's been searching for the money case inside the hotel room. That's what the synopsis tells me. I don't remember it being that close.
Well, Chigurh was on the other side of the door when Bell went in, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yep.
I don't know how. Yeah. The geography of the scene eluded me. Like, I don't know how they missed each other.
And then Sheriff Bell visits his Uncle Ellis, played by Barry Corbin, from Anger Management and One Tree Hill, and tells him he's going to retire because of the violence he's seen. Nah. By the way, Ellis is like a cat lady who's in a wheelchair because he was killed on the job, on the sheriffing job.
He was killed on the job?
I'm sorry, he was not killed. He was injured.
He was wounded. Yeah, Ellis was supposed to be his uncle?
That's what it says.
I thought it was his brother.
It says uncle.
They seem more like brothers, but all right. It's the South. Who knows?
Exact cousin. Let's call him a cousin. We'll split the difference.
He was kin.
Apparently he was zombie kin.
Well, there's some clever dialogue in here where basically, you know, Ed Tom is saying that, you know, he's like, just like the world has kind of gone away from him. You know, he always figured that he, as he got older, God would kind of come into his life, and he didn't. Although he doesn't blame him, because if I was him, I'd have the same opinion of me that he does. But yeah, he's kind of bemoaning the fact that the world is getting uglier. And Ellis tells him straight up, what you got ain't nothing new. This country is hard on people. You can't stop what's coming. It ain't all waiting on you. That's just vanity talking. It's always been a cruel world.
It's very Terminator-esque. You can't stop what's coming.
Yeah, plus, it's always been bad, you know? It was bad when your dad was killed, or I guess his own dad was killed, right? Somebody's dad was killed. Grandpa, maybe? I don't know. This world's always been a bad place. Still a bad place. It's not getting worse. It's just getting on. It's you that's changing.
Such a pick-me-up.
Ellis is a bit of a nihilist.
You think? The movie is kind of nihilistic in that way.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Then we go back down and see Carla Jean, who is attending a funeral. Turns out to be a funeral for her mother, who made good on her her prediction of dying of cancer.
The cancer.
So Chigurh meets up with Carla Jean and has a nice long speech prepared about flipping the coin. And she's like, no, I'm not playing your game. You know, she did in the most declarative exposition in there, just calls Chigurh on his shit, saying it's always been you, has nothing to do with the coin, you're either going to kill me or you're not, and you got to deal with it. And I wasn't sure, frankly. I guess I should ask you guys, did you think he killed her the first time you saw her?
Yes.
Yeah. Based on the shoes?
Yes.
No, I didn't catch the shoes. Based on the fact that he's a sociopathic asshole who is still ticked off at Llewellyn.
Yeah. He made this big extended scene of checking the soles of his shoes as if he'd walked through dog crap when he exited the house.
Yeah, or blood, I think, was the idea.
I know, but that's what it looked like. He's
kind of finicky in that way.
I did not catch that. I mean, I caught the shoe thing, but I didn't connect it with blood.
Yeah, that's what they're... I think that's what they were trying to tell us. But then, Brother Jay's least favorite thing in movies, I think we talked about that recently. Did it give you flashbacks?
Yeah.
Yeah. But we still have to see adaptation more sooner than later, because that was the first time I had seen this thing that's now common in every TV show and commercial of somebody driving along from inside the car, POV, and then they get into a car accident, and it's very disorienting.
Yeah, that's stupid. There's an Allstate ad, I think. It's an Allstate. Maybe it's a Subaru ad that every time I hear it, if I see it come on, I cannot change the channel fast enough, because it triggers something.
Through the eyes of an angel.
No, it's not like Dying Pets.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. The Sarah McLachlan song. That's my wife's version of that is the that song. That commercial.
My wife's too.
Turns out it's mine too. Not because it gives me the feels, but because my dog will bark at the dogs.
No, see, Derek actually scrambles across the room to change the channel when those ads come on. I can't have the feels. Turn it.
And is, okay, does it disturb you that all of us don't have the similar reaction when those Sally Struthers ads about starving children were on TV? Like, it's a visceral response to change the channel when you see the sad dog who's being abused, but you see an actual human being that's starving to death in a foreign country.
I don't like those either.
Oh, okay. Maybe I should feel bad about myself.
Maybe. But there's also something, there's something more personal about the pets, because we've all owned pets.
That's true.
I don't think any of us has owned a starving child.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, so, sorry. So as Sugar is driving off, he is broadsided by this car in the middle of an intersection as he's trying to get away. And he is pretty severely injured. But he's Sugar. He can't wait for the police to show up and file an accident report. Instead, he has to do what a lot of people do here to solve problems in Texas in 1980. He buys clothing from passersby. And although I did find the scene kind of funny and it reminded me a little bit of Mud.
Yeah, those kids just want to help out.
Yeah. Well, no, the one did. The other one just wanted half the money. So,
well, afterwards.
Yeah, he didn't really want the money beforehand. He says, I'll give you my shirt for free, mister.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I mean the other kid. The other kid wanted half the money, even though he didn't give up the shirt. No.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then this is so Sugar uses the arm to sling up his broken arm. There's bone sticking out of your arm, mister. There's a bone coming out of your arm. Yeah, so he limps away. And then we kind of flash to Sheriff Bell's house after his retirement. And he's having breakfast with his wife, Loretta, who is not retired. And she asked him how he slept. And he said that he had dreams. And then he gives us this the last thing, and I'll throw in the quote, because it's interesting.
How'd you sleep?
I don't know. I had dreams.
Well, you got time for them now. Anything interesting?
There always is to the party concerned.
And Tom, I'll be polite.
All right, then. Two of them both have my father in them. It's peculiar. I'm older now than he ever was by 20 years. So, in a sense, he's the younger man. Anyway, the first one I don't remember too well, but it was about meeting him in town somewhere and he gave me some money. I think I lost it. The second one, it was like we was both back in the older times. And I was a horseback going through the mountains of a night, going through this pass in the mountains. It was cold and there was snow on the ground. And he rode past me and kept on going, never said nothing going by, just rode on past. And he had his blanket wrapped around him and his head down. When he rode past, I seen he was carrying fire and a horn the way people used to do. And I could see the horn from the light inside of it, about the color of the moon. And in a dream, I knew that he was going on ahead. And he's fixing to make a fire somewhere out there and all that dark and all that cold. And I knew that whenever I got there, he'd be there. Then I woke up.
About how he had dreams of basically his father guiding him to heaven or death or whatever. Like he was going to join his father soon in death. Is that what you got from it too?
Yes. He said something really interesting, that his dad died at a younger age than he was now. So in his dream, his father was a younger man, which is a weird concept. Like, I think our father can relate to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. That one made me think a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Wow. If you meet these people, like, I am 10 years away from being as old as our grandfather Clyde ever got.
Yeah. That seems so young now.
It does. Oh, man. Yeah, absolutely. So, there will be blood. No, I'm sorry. So,
wow.
So, No Country for Old Men. I've got some trivia, if you want to hear it.
Sure.
Always.
There's this line in the movie where Sheriff Bell talks about how they even killed a judge. Well, apparently there was a contract killing on a judge kind of around that time, like the late 70s. And the contract killer was Charles Harrelson, Woody Harrelson's father.
Ooh.
Yeah, he was a bad guy, and he has been accused of being one of the guys on the grassy knoll in Dallas.
Jeez.
So there's not much evidence that he was actually like the grassy knoll shooter, but you'll find that floating around. Donald Trump would certainly accuse him of that if he ever made his political views known to be Democratic. Although I don't actually see that happening. But
explains a little bit why Woody Harrelson is such a weirdo.
Yeah. Yeah.
Apparently not a stable home life.
No, not at all. Well, maybe stable, but not a fatherless home life, I think. So anyway, in September of 2008, Tommy Lee Jones sued Paramount for bonuses and improper record keeping. I don't know if we've had the conversation, we must have, about Winston Groom and Forrest Gump. You know, Winston Groom, the author of Forrest Gump and the sequel to Forrest Gump, sold his rights to the movie for a percentage of the net. Well, that's a problem in movies because movies are designed to lose money. That's why, like, every movie has a different production company, because they're all designed to kind of come out even. Winston Groom never got paid a dime for Forrest Gump because the accounting showed that it never made any money. So Winston Groom's response is, fuck you, you will not be getting the sequel. And he never did. He never sold the sequel rights. Even though they were probably, you know, they probably would have actually wrote him a big check for it. But he's like, no, screw me once. So Tommy Lee Jones actually sued Paramount. And in 2010, the company was forced to pay him $17.5 million for the box office bonus.
Whoa.
I guess the studio attorneys apparently wrote the contract wrong, according to Paramount. And so Paramount actually sued the studio attorneys, and they settled for like $2.6 million over an error, accounting error. But yeah. So he tried to get screwed, and he took him to court, and he won. It's pretty great. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, here we go. So in the novel, Sheriff Bell says one of the dope dealers back in San Antonio shot and killed a federal judge. Well, in 1979, federal judge John Howland Wood was shot and killed in San Antonio by Texas freelance contract killer Charles Harrelson, father of actor Woody Harrelson. So, are we ready for the connections?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
I got two of them last week.
I did, yeah. It's because I got none of them the week before. So. No Country for Old Men, starring Javier Bardem. Who was in Dance with the Devil with Rosie Perez. Who starred in Untamed Heart with Christian Slater. Who starred in Interview with the Vampire with Tom Cruise. Who starred in Eyes Wide Shut, directed by Stanley Kubrick, who directed 2001 A Space Odyssey. Incidentally, Rosie Perez's character in Dance with the Devil is Perdita Durango. Do you recognize that name? Perdita Durango is the character that Isabella Rossellini played in Wild at Heart. It's the same character.
It is. It is indeed.
Yeah.
Same source material?
I believe so.
Interesting. I've seen Dance with the Devil. I have not seen Wild at Heart.
Oh, Wild at Heart is actually great. In fact, you'll be getting a Wild at Heart episode coming out soon.
Woohoo! It's got a cast of thousands.
Oh, it's great. Yeah.
It is a great movie. It is, yeah.
At some point, we should consider watching Untamed Heart.
Oh, God.
Because I remember it being horrible and great all at the same time.
We should just double feature that with the Pump Up the Volume.
Oh, we could, yes. The whole Christian Slater oeuvre.
He thinks he has like a baboon heart, right?
Yes, yeah. He thinks or he does? Dun dun. So, Brother Jay, what's your judgment?
Well, again, I think it was a beautiful movie. I think it was very well acted, but did not like the story. Did not like the movie. Will not be watching it again. Was not satisfied with the story or the ending. Or the tangents.
Brother Drew, was it worth it?
I think it was totally worth it. It was, I really liked it. I thought it was fun. It moved along really quickly, and it had some really memorable characters.
Yep, and snappy dialogue.
Very snappy. Yeah. But I think it should give its Oscar to There Will Be Blood.
Yeah, I think so. So, let's see. We're pretty much done with No Country for Old Men. On to housekeeping.
Housekeeping!
Who wants to go
Drew
first?
Drew has a dazed look.
Yeah, hey, welcome back, Drew. Let's start with you. You have housekeeping, probably, since you've been flying around the world. You'll notice, if you heard the last episode, that Brother Jay saved everyone from hand puppetry.
I did enjoy, Jason, I did enjoy that you throwing Eric under the bus at every possible opportunity.
I wasn't throwing him under the bus. He was making sock puppet motions.
Oh, yeah, but you were like, no, that's all you. I had nothing to do with this ever. I told you it was a bad idea from the beginning. You keep doing it. You're digging your own grave. That's you. Yeah. It's you. Not me.
Yeah. That wasn't throwing him under the bus. That was just giving him enough rope to hang himself.
That was great. But, yeah, no, I had a fun time. Took 8 helicopter trips last week.
Oh. Do you get special miles for that?
No, you get years taken off your life. That's about it. I had a really fun moment with a flight suit. I don't know if any of you have ever had the pleasure of putting on something like a Mustang suit, but it's designed to keep you afloat in water. So that it has like really thick, like it's totally booted.
Wait, can I point out that I've never been in a Mustang suit, but once at a furry convention, I dressed as an Appaloosa.
Okay, yeah, no, I've seen pictures. But so, yeah, so these suits have these really thick neoprene cuffs and neck, to keep you dry while you're being rescued. Although the more cynical guy in my office said they're just bright orange so that they can find your body easier.
They can fish you out of the water.
Yeah. But so they're kind of difficult to get into because they're really thick and bulky. So you sort of, it's this whole procedure where you have to put in your right arm. You got to get your legs in. And then you got to pull, because it's like got this diagonal zipper that goes across your chest. That's how you get into it. Then you sort of have to pull the neck from behind your head and pull the suit up, and you kind of have to angle your head into the neoprene neck hole and then slide it over your head and face. And then once you do that, you get your left arm in and zip up. But there was a moment where I was sliding this over my face. So my face was totally engulfed in this neoprene, which was like sucked around it. And I lost, you have to pull so hard that I lost my grip on the suit.
Oh no.
So there's, it was just like that split second where I was no longer in control of this thing that was suffocating me, and I was off balance, and I was in like a room full of seasoned, like hardened field guys. So all at once, I had to like figure out how to not panic and start to flail about like I was drowning in my flight suit. I'm sure nobody cared or was even looking at me, but it was so panic inducing. Just that one second before I could find my handhold again and get my head through that neck hole. But yeah, it could have gone horribly wrong, and I could have like flailed and probably made a horribly unmanly sound, and probably fallen on my face, and maybe even gotten a workplace injury, which would not have been good.
Oh, God, that is awesome. We had a okay, so I work in an office with desk chairs, right? Should not be. The dangers you face in my office would be like tripping over improperly placed heater cord or something. Occasionally there's have been like a hole in the floor because we have like a raised flooring system because there's a whole bunch of wires underneath. So there's been a couple times where the actual flooring has a hole in it that just was carpeted over but never actually patched. So we had somebody like back a chair wheel into that and they could take a spill. But we once had a coworker that was sitting, and she was, sort of a shorter person, like a smallish person. And she had her legs all wrapped around the base of the chair. Like they were up off the floor and like sort of cupped around the chair.
Kind of like ballerina style around her male skating partner.
Yeah,
kind
of. And for reasons that no one knows, she just spontaneously like burst out of the chair, like wah, like with no notice, no warning, just was like wah, she's on the floor. And of course, they had to call the paramedics to come in, and they stretchered her out of our room from a spontaneous chair eruption. So that's always a bad thing.
Did she ever cop to what happened?
Well, no, I'm sure it was all very serious. I mean, I'm sure this is funny. Half the people in the room were probably like immediately turning away so that she wouldn't see them laughing, bursting out laughing, assuming that somebody else would take the position of going to see if she was okay. It's unclear whether anybody actually asked her whether it was okay or anyway. But, somebody had to cover her position because she was at a place where you couldn't just take a break. Somebody had to actually man her position. So, staff her position, let's say.
That was very PC.
Yeah. Anyway, that's me, Mr. PC. So, that's not nearly as dramatic, although it is, it sounds like what you were fearing.
Yeah, that exactly. I would not want to be stretched out.
No.
And have to have somebody cut me out of a half donned flight suit.
No. It's not like being stretchered out of a movie theater.
but you had a real injury though.
Yeah, but that doesn't make it any less like embarrassing. Especially when they're wheeling you out.
I was gonna say, you can use your flashlights to guide the stretcher in.
They're wheeling you out of the lobby, and people are like, oh, God, I hope it wasn't the popcorn.
They warned us about the cook, the thief, the wife, and his lover.
Oh, God, a terrible movie. Miramax.
So, Drew, before we go on to other business, we had a request for a medical update. How you doing?
That's funny. Yeah, not great.
Oh no!
I've been off, completely off the steroids for maybe, is it 2 weeks? I don't even know. It's either 1 or 2 weeks, maybe 2 weeks now. Some of the symptoms are starting to come back. Like it's funny you ask, because I just noticed tonight I was looking at my feet and my ankles are starting to get swollen again. Which is sort of one of the first indicator symptoms of when this whole thing started. So, and all of my joints have been achy for a while, but, like strep throat and the flu have been running rampant around my household. So, you know, who knows what's going on? Like, I'm not getting any real sleep and everybody's sick. So I don't know. It's a disaster over here. Thanks for asking.
Yeah, no problem.
So I
appreciate everyone's concern.
Oh no, there is worldwide concern.
Have you had your house tested for mold?
No. I have not had any cause, but yeah, could be anything.
That sucks. Well, yeah, wishing you the best.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's the uncertainty. That sucks.
Yeah, it's kind of bullshit.
Yeah.
It's very frustrating when modern medicine, the best answer is meh.
Yeah. Maybe a virus? Like, why are you making it sound like a question? You're the doctor.
So, anything else before we move on to Brother Jay?
I do. This is actually a request from our parents. They have a list of movies that they would like us to just give a brief yes/no. Should they watch them on their vacation?
Okay, you have that list.
I do. You ready?
Okay, ready.
Deadpool.
I have not seen it, but I've heard that I actually considered taking mom to it one day when Journey was in school, and everybody at my work says, do not take your mother to Deadpool.
Yeah, it's, I think Dad would not be able, it's very, very, very not a dad movie.
Because of the pegging?
in a word.
UrbanDictionary.com, mom.
Wait, hold on. don't think for a second that our parents would have to go to Urban Dictionary. Remember, they lived during the 70s. Those people invented that shit. I'm just pointing this out.
Do you even know what it means?
Do I know what it means? Of course I know what it means.
We're all adults.
Yeah.
Exactly. I would submit that movie's probably a little on the gory side for our father.
Okay. How about Hunger Games, Mockingjay, Part 2, especially if you've seen all the other ones?
Well, of course.
I haven't seen Part 2 yet, but I would, you know, they should, just to finish it out.
Yeah, if you've seen all the other ones, you definitely have to watch that one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang?
Of course.
Yes, absolutely.
Ultraviolet, the British TV series.
I loved it. Idris Elba?
I haven't seen it.
It's only 6 episodes, got some interesting stuff going on. Loved it.
Nightcrawler.
I have not seen it, but I've heard good things.
Haven't seen it.
No.
Banff.
I haven't seen it either.
It's a Banff joke there, right there. Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah, I know. It's not all that funny, but it makes me laugh.
Those are all the mom movies. Here are the dad ones. Blood Ties.
Oh, wow. I have no idea.
Never heard of it?
No. Nope.
It is a Clive Owen movie from 2013.
Yes.
With Marianne Cotillard and Billy Crudup. Wow. It's a crime drama.
Okay. I don't know. Never heard of it.
That's going under the Let Us Know category.
Yeah, that looks great, but I don't know, yeah.
Big Lebowski?
Yes.
Of course. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
That's a Coen Brothers flick.
Yeah, meh. All right.
It's got some funny stuff.
2 out of 3. Bone Tomahawk?
I've heard only good things, but I've heard it's pretty bloody when it comes to the end. Although, again, they watched Hateful Eight.
Yeah, the only thing Dad has said about that is it's long.
Yeah.
Well, if that's his only criticism of it, then I think that's a pretty good endorsement.
Yeah, but Kurt Russell in a Western? What's not like to like?
How about Ambush at Dark Canyon?
Well, of course. I have no idea what that is, but it sounds thrilling right there.
This is a starring vehicle for Kick Brooks.
Kick Brooks?
Mm-hmm.
Son of Garth?
Of Brooks and Dunn.
Ah.
Oh, God.
Excellent.
I was afraid that's who that was.
Well, you know what? That's right on par, though, with Jesse Stone, Tom Selleck, Western guy.
I said avoid at all costs.
Okay.
Vendetta.
I don't know anything about it.
Where are they looking for these movies from?
I have no idea. This could either be a 2013 movie starring no one I've ever heard of, or a 2015 movie starring Dean Cain and some wrestler called The Big Show.
Okay. No. In a word, no. Shootout at WrestleMania Canyon? No.
The Prince.
Machiavelli's The Prince?
I think it's a Jason Patrick, Bruce Willis, John Cusack movie from 2014.
Oh, well, yes, then. It's got everybody you like. If it's going to be a bad movie, at least it'll have Bruce Willis and John Cusack and whatever that third guy was.
And Korean superstar Rain.
I don't know Korean superstar Rain, but what can you do?
Okay, so that's a yes, and let us know.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's all I had. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, no, we're glad you're back.
Thanks for being back. So, Brother Jay, housekeeping.
So, did you guys get the pictures of Dad's new truck?
Yes.
Yes, my wife commented that that truck is the same color that their house used to be when we were in high school.
Don't tell Dad that.
Not quite. It's actually really pretty. It's hard to get the good color in the pictures because they have it indoors away from everybody else because it's a special order. So it won't see the lot at all, which is good, I guess. But, yeah. I've arranged with the sales manager, I will be taking delivery of the vehicle Saturday. And so I will be picking them up in the airport in it.
Oh, sweet.
So
very nice.
That's very bold, so, too, as I mentioned before.
Yes.
Well, that's a surprise. I'm insured. I mean, besides, Dad already said once, he's like, do you think we could go out to the dealership after dinner on Saturday? And it's like, they wouldn't be open. Like, by the time we're done with dinner, they're not going to be, well, I just want to go see it. Like, I understand. I get it. I'm the same way. I'm like, we can cancel dinner or we can reschedule dinner for later. No. So
that's awesome. That's going to work great.
So, I'm going to take delivery Saturday afternoon and then I'm going to basically take it to the airport parking lot and park it on the roof away from every other possible vehicle next to a light pole. So hopefully that will work out well.
That'd be really cool.
Yeah. That sounds fun.
So that'll be an experience. And then Saturday, we're going to dinner, and then Sunday, we're going to the dealership so they can fill out all the paperwork and get me off the hook. And then I'm loading all of the stuff that is in the staging area in my office here, putting it in the back of their SUV so they can leave Monday morning.
Sweet.
And apparently, Dad has mailed me a box today containing his laptop and the defibrillator.
Excellent.
So I asked Mom, I said, does he not like the laptop that he mailed it?
Well.
Because he wants to travel light.
They're annoying to travel with.
Yeah.
I wouldn't put mine in the mail, though.
Yeah, you got to make your choices.
But, anyway, they'll be here Saturday, so it'll be fun to have him around. Hopefully it'll be good weather, and hopefully they'll make good time on the drive back. God knows that, from judging from the box of parts, spare parts, and new tools that have arrived at my house, he can rebuild the vehicle if he has to.
Excellent.
Oh, he will.
So, that'd be fun. Hope they're looking forward to it.
Did you listen to the... Oh, yeah, you did. I listened to the internet episode, Drew. Do you feel like you were left out of an important episode?
No. No, I really enjoyed listening to you guys talk about it. And while you were talking about the fact that I didn't like Kevin Kline, I remembered a movie that I really liked Kevin Klein in.
French Kiss?
I had a hard time. No, I had a hard time remembering the title. It was something like I Love You to Death with Tracy Ullman.
Oh, yeah. That's a great movie.
That was like a really, really dark comedy, which I thought he was great in.
Yeah. I mean,
he played most of the movie incapacitated, but in a very funny way.
Wow. A Lawrence Kasdan feature with...
Is it called I Love You to Death?
It is. It's Kevin Klein, okay. Tracy Ullman, Joan Plowright, River Phoenix, William Hurt, Keanu Reeves, Jack Keller, Victoria Jackson.
Oh.
That had to be like really early 90s.
Heather Graham, Kathleen York. And then, of course, uncredited, we have Phoebe Cates.
Of course.
Yeah. And yeah, it's 1990.
Yep, that sounds about right.
Joey owns a pizza parlor and is married to Rosalie and is a major womanizer. Rosalie goes to extremes when she finds he's been cheating.
Based on a true story.
Carly Rae Underwood songs reminiscent of. It's called Felony Malicious Destruction of Property.
Carrie Underwood.
Carrie Underwood, yes, where she carves her name to the side of his pretty little something-something four-wheel drive. And carved her name into his leather seat. This is expensive stuff. That's a felony. It's also a domestic violence crime. Mandatory minimums. She should be going to jail. Anyway, did you have other housekeeping? We can work out
that later. No, I don't. I do not.
Okay, cool. All right, so I think I will, until next week, thank you again. Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on our new voicemail account to leave voice messages, or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.